We had just started the fifth chapter and we did not make much advance because this fifth chapter marks a beginning of a new line of arguments. And there was a need to join up. The end of the argument of the fourth chapter or first four chapters with the argument of the fifth chapter and onwards. The argument of the chapters 5, 6, and 7 is one line of argument. And I pointed out that first four chapters and these three chapters can be linked together if it is understood that the entire drift of the whole book is to discover if there is design in this world. It doesn't assume there is a design. But Sri Aurobindo says that if you are a philosopher, then the first task of a philosopher is to ask if there is a design and to look for a design. If you are not a philosopher, then this task is not imposed on you. If you are only a poet, you need not. If you are a mere scientist, you need not ask this question. You can only describe what you are saying. But if you are a philosopher, and if you say, I want to understand philosophically all that I am seeing, then Sri Aurobindo says, then you must ask this question, if there is any design, and try to see if there is a design. It's only when you have tried your best and not find any design at all, then you can surely are free. There is no assumption. In philosophy, you should be free from all assumptions. There need not be any design in the world at all. World is what it is. That is why, if you remember, at one time I read out to you a paragraph from the Life Divine, which describes the world as a chance. A few days ago, I read out to you one full paragraph from the Life Divine, where Sri Aurobindo describes the theory of chance. So that theory also has to be taken into account, because it is quite possible there is no design. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo takes all of us and says, if you want to study philosophically this world as you find it, then you should ask this question, if there is any design. And the whole book is actually an exposition of looking for a design. Now, in looking for a design, he started with it and came to a conclusion at a certain point. And if you do not know this particular design, then you may not be able to link up these four chapters with the fifth, sixth, and seventh chapters. Therefore, I need to repeat. Why? Because at the end of the fourth chapter, you are describing the ultimate reality. And we need to be reminded why Sri Aurobindo has been led to describe the ultimate reality. It is as a result of a questioning, if there is a design. In the search of a design, the search for ultimate reality became necessary. And as a result of that, he made inquiry into the nature of the ultimate reality. Having described it is likely that many people might say, now it is ended. Because philosophically, when you describe the ultimate reality, there is a satisfaction in the human consciousness. When you know what is ultimate reality, there is a pause in the human consciousness. And therefore, it is likely that having read what is the ultimate reality, you might feel that now all that is to be said has been said. It is ended. Sri Aurobindo says it is not ended. It is only a part of the argument And I have led you to this point, which I am now repeating. And therefore, the fifth chapter begins with the repetition of the conclusions that has been reached at the end of the fourth chapter by describing what is the nature of the ultimate reality. Now, Sri Aurobindo's argument goes forward and says, this ultimate reality, being what it is, will help us, is likely to help us in discovering the design of this world. Does it? Does it not? What are the facts which need to be brought forward so that you understand the design of this world? Now, one very important question, which is actually the whole link in the whole book, is what is the whole world designed to accomplish, and whether in that accomplishment, in the world as I see it, I am also standing as a part of the total scene, whether I have any role to play, and if so, what is my role? This is the question which is asked in the chapter number 5, 6, 7. Having seen what is ultimate reality, an ultimate reality is ultimate because it should be the key to everything that is in the world. That's the meaning of an ultimate reality. An ultimate reality is that reality which is the key to everything in the world. Now Sri Aurobindo says, what are the facts of the world, and now compare with the ultimate reality. So, there are 3 or 4 or 5 important facts. There is first a fact of suffering, death, pain, evil. These are facts. Secondly, there is in me a state of egoism.
Egoism.
It's a fact. There is a state of egoism in my consciousness. It is in that state I am asking the question, what is my role here? If reality is this much, if there is pain, suffering and so on, can these two statements jar with each other? They contradict each other? And therefore I have still a chance to ask whether what I have described as ultimate reality is really ultimate reality. If I cannot show that there is here a key even to pain and suffering and evil, and also to my egoism and my egoistic feelings, and my also demand whether I have any role to play here or not, if this cannot be fitted into what I have described as ultimate reality, then I am able to question even that. And I am quite free to do so. At present, however, Sri Aurobindo says, we have discovered the ultimate reality on a very solid ground. What is the solid ground? On the basis of the discovery of the highest possible experiences. On the assumption that experience reveals the reality. If experience was not the means of revelation of reality, I would not have taken recourse to the discussion of experiences. But because reality is known to be reality only through experience, and experience does reveal the reality, therefore Sri Aurobindo has taken us on a long line of the expanding of experiences, going up to experience of the cosmic consciousness, going to the experience of the transcendental experience, going to the experience of non-existence or nihil, and still a beyond. All this has been seen, in which ultimately Sri Aurobindo says, if at all you want to speak about it, first of all you must admit you cannot speak about it. It is something in which all contraries meet. Therefore, any statement you make will be contradicted. Any statement you will make, if you say it is existence, it is not existence. If you say it is consciousness, it is not consciousness. It is delight, it is not delight. If you say it is one, you say no, there are many. If you say unity, you can say discord. These are all the contradictory propositions which come. And Sri Aurobindo says, in a sense, you can't define it. But if you at all want to define it for the sake of understanding, is there any way of defining it? So Sri Aurobindo says that there is a way of defining. You say it is Sat, Chit and Ananda. Keeping in mind also that even that description is not to be taken in a verbal way to be the ultimately real description of the reality. But it will give you an indication by which you can move forward in your thinking process. This is all that is said in the very first paragraph of the chapter number 5. Now, you read the second chapter. Second para. But this unity is in its nature indefinable. When we seek to envisage it by the mind, we are compelled to proceed through an infinite series of conceptions and experiences. And yet in the end, we are obliged to negate our largest conceptions, our most comprehensive experiences, in order to affirm that the reality exceeds all definitions. We arrive at the formula of the Indian sages, neti neti. It is not this, it is not that. There is no experience by which we can limit it. There is no conception by which it can be defined. It's only a restatement of a complete affirmation which admits all negations and says it is not definable. But it is unknowable. And I described to you last time what is unknowable. Unknowable is a wonder and is known as wonder. And unknowable, which appears to us in many states and attributes of being, in many forms of consciousness, in many activities of energy. This is what mind can ultimately say about the existence which we ourselves are and which we see in all that is presented to our thought and senses. Now this statement, this is what mind can ultimately say about the existence. It's a very interesting statement because I was speaking to yesterday of Spinoza. And I said Spinoza defines ultimate reality as substance. And he said substance is that which exists in itself and which can be conceived only through itself. Then this is one of his first statements. The second statement that he makes is also very interesting. He says, although it can be conceived through itself, as far as our mind is concerned, our mind tries to conceive it. And he says that what our mind conceives of it is only attributes of it. It cannot understand that substance in itself. That substance can be understood only in itself, only through it. If you are yourself God, you will understand what is God. But as far as we are concerned, at the highest, if you take to your mind at the highest, then also you try to conceive of it, and when you conceive of it, you will only get attributes of that substance. You cannot do more than that. So, now when Sri Aurobindo says, whatever mind can envisage, Sri Aurobindo actually, you may say, he is repeating what Spinoza at his highest thought, he had said about the reality. It is stated in one line simply. An unknowable which appears to us in many states and attributes of being, in many forms of consciousness, in many activities of energy, this is what mind can ultimately say about the existence which we ourselves are and which we see in all that is presented to our thought and senses. It is in and through those states, those forms, those activities that we have to approach and know the unknowable. Is exactly what Spinoza said. He said, this reality must have theoretically infinite attributes. But our mind being what it is, it can only conceive this reality only in two attributes. That is his conclusion. He said, our mind, if you examine the mind and if it looks at the substance and tries to understand it, it has got to say it must have infinite attributes. Why infinite? Because it's only one substance. There is nothing else which can limit it. Since it cannot be limited, it must have infinite attributes. But our mind being what it is, it can only see two attributes. What are those two attributes? He says, the one attribute that we can see is thought. That is, this substance is having an attribute of thought. The second is, it has got extension. These are the only two attributes we can see of it. We can see, because our mind cannot see, our mind itself has only capacity of these two things. Our mind can only think, or it can only see in extension. This being the only thing, we can do nothing more than this. In other words, without using the terms of Indian philosophy, it says reality can be seen as Brahman. Brahman is that which expands, extends. And reality is that which is chit, thought. He did not speak of Ananda, but he says that reality is Sat and it is chit. So the only two things we can see is, it is Brahman and it is chit. That is his conclusion. Now Sri Aurobindo also tells us, he doesn't tell us to limit ourselves to Spinoza, because Spinoza, this is his point of view. Sri Aurobindo says that if we want to know that unknowable, we cannot know in itself. We can only know the attributes. Different states of being, different states of consciousness, different states of your sensitivity. These are all that we can know. And through this, we are trying to approach that reality. But if in our haste to arrive at a unity that our mind can seize and hold, if in our insistence to confine the infinite in our embrace, we identify reality with any one definable state of being, however pure and eternal, with any particular attribute, however general and comprehensive, with any fixed formulation of consciousness, however vast in scope, with any energy or activity, however boundless its application, and if we exclude all the rest, then our thoughts sin against its unknowableness and arrive not at a true unity, but at a division of the indivisible. This is like Spinoza saying that the reality has got infinite attributes. If you limit it to this attribute or to that attribute, you are sinning against its infinity and also its indivisibility. This is also the conclusion of the Vedanta. It is very interesting for any student of comparative philosophy to see how, if you look at the history of Western thought and Indian thought, you will see that human thought is by its nature so universal, you don't need to be Eastern or Western. You need to have only the mind working in its own rights. And the mind, when it thinks of the highest, the conclusion is the same whether in the East or in the West. This idea that ultimate reality is substance which can exist only in itself and which can be conceived only through itself is also the highest that India defines its ultimate reality as. That which exists in itself, Sat, and which can be conceived only through itself, Chit. And this that it is, it must have infinite attributes. It cannot be limited to anything. This statement also is a statement of Indian philosophy. Therefore, both in the East and the West, as far as ultimate description of reality is concerned, there is no opposition. The two coincide if you look at the two trends without presuppositions, without preconceptions, without the idea of antagonism, and without being snared by some words which are used here and which are not used there. If you try to understand what is behind the words, what is being tried to be conveyed, you will find that East and West, when it considers what is thought and what thought can envisage the highest, the descriptions are the same, basically. Now, Sri Aurobindo goes farther and says, not only what is conceived at the highest, it also coincides with what is experienced at the highest. This is one special point of view of the Eastern thought. It not only tries to conceive the highest, it also wants to experience the highest. Now there again, I am making a sin against the truth. Because even in the West, it is not as if this attitude of experiencing is absent and there is only attitude of thinking. Even in the West, the Western thought started with experience. Just as in India also, we started with experience. In the West also, if you read the earlier stages of civilization, particularly Orphic civilization, it is an attempt to experience the highest. The Veda also is nothing but an approach of experience and to lead experience to the highest. The cleavage came later on. In fact, Socrates and Plato mark a point of cleavage. Socrates and Plato were children of mystics, but they were the parents of rationalism. So a starting point of emphasis on reason started with Socrates and Plato. Even one who was like Pythagoras, who came earlier, his emphasis on reason was not so great as in spiritual experience. Sri Aurobindo, while explaining the Indian history, he has made a very important statement. The one distinguishing mark of Indian history was the period of Upanishads. In India, we started with spiritual experience. It degenerated. It started with the Veda, then came a period of Brahmanas. Brahmanas reduced the spiritual experience into rituals. There would have been a revolt against it, as it happened in the West. Orphism also started with spiritual experiences, and then it reduced itself into worship of gods and goddesses and ritualism. Then came a revolt against it of the reason. And that is what is presented by Socrates and Plato. That is the reason why it was argued that Socrates does not believe in the gods. That was one of the accusations against Socrates, which is partly true and partly not true. He believed in God. He also worshipped gods, but not in the way in which there was a general popular way in which ritualism, which was prevalent, he did not fall into ritualism. And therefore, there was revolt against Socrates from the side of ritualists. So, there came about a resistance to ritualism in the form of Socrates and Plato. And they started a movement called rationalism. In India, however, when ritualism developed, corresponding to ritualism in ancient period of West, there was a revolt against ritualism. But it was not followed by the period of reason. And this is a very distinguishing feature of Indian history. The period that came after Brahmanas was not the period of philosophy, but the period of Upanishads. It was the period in which spiritual experiences were revived. Spirituality was revived. The spirituality of the Veda, which tended to be forgotten in the Brahmanas, came to be revisited. It was a fresh approach, a fresh wave came. It is as if from the God's point of view, there are two wings. On one wing, God experimented with spirituality, and keeping an emphasis on spirituality intact. In the West, God allowed an experience of spirituality to begin with, and then starting a period of reason. As a result, the two historical developments began to move on different lines. God is neither favorable to East or to West. He is favorable to the whole humanity. And he wanted to make an experiment. Supposing I allow a culture to develop more on a spiritual line and another on a rational line, what will happen? It's an experiment. Therefore, in India, this wave or tide came in India of a revival of a spirituality. And Upanishads came. Therefore, there was in the inner history of India, if you want to see the inner history, it started with intuition, went into ritualism, and there was a return of intuition. It was after that period that the line of development which took place in the West was also allowed to take place here, namely period of reason. That is why it is after Upanishads that philosophical systems began to be developed in India. Upanishads give way only to spiritual revival. That's why Sri Aurobindo says, Upanishads are not philosophical works. They are only statements of spiritual experiences. But in a language which is not so figurative as the Veda. Much more easy for us to understand. That is why, since it is a revival of the Vedic experience, and since Vedic experience is not understandable to us, we are told you just read Upanishads, which are more easy to understand. It is nothing but Veda. So if this tradition has remained in India, instead of going to the Veda, you go to Upanishads, it's the same thing. And there's a further thing also later on when Gita came, they said, even Gita is only a restatement of the Veda. So this period of the Upanishads was a distinctive feature of Indian history. And because of this curve, the rhythm of Indian history is different from the rhythm of the West. Having made these experiments for a long time, with a special emphasis on spirituality in Indian history, with a special emphasis on reason in the West, from the humanities point of view, we have to now come together and to see the total result. If you move on this line, what happens? If you live on one side, what happens? We have come to that point. This is what Sri Aurobindo's basic point here is, from the historical point of view. Today we stand at the point where we can take stock of what has happened to the Indian experiment and what has happened to the European experiment. It is in the light of that historical development that all that we are now thinking has a relevance. We have now a possibility of taking stock of both the histories, put together the treasures of both, and then revisit the problems of existence and the design of the world, and try to see the significance of this world from that point of view. That is why that famous paragraph in the second chapter, chapter number 2, paragraph number 7. It is therefore of good augury that after many experiments and verbal solutions, we should now find ourselves standing today in the presence of the two that have alone borne for long the most rigorous tests of experience, the two extremes, and that at the end of the experience, both should have come to a result with the universal instinct in mankind that veil judge, sentinel, and representative of the universal spirit of truth refuses to accept as right or as satisfying. In Europe and in India, respectively, the negation of the materialists and the refusal of the ascetic have sought to assert themselves as the sole truth and to dominate the conception of life. In India, if the result has been a great heaping of the treasures of the spirits or of some of them, it has also been a great bankruptcy of life. In Europe, the fullness of riches and the triumphant mastery of this world's powers and possessions have progressed towards an equal bankruptcy in the things of the spirits. Nor has the intellect, which sought the solution of all problems in one term of matter, found satisfaction in the answer that it has received. This is the conclusion of present day, that is where we stand today. And that is why the possibility and necessity of synthesis of the East and the West. You both have started on the same line. It is not as if Aurobindo said, do not make a distinction between East and West so sharp, as if to say, India has never been materialistic, and West has never been spiritualistic. It is not true. There is only an emphasis. At a given time in history, there an emphasis came up. If you read Sri Aurobindo's message to America, which he gave in 1950, it's a very important message, where the first sentence that Sri Aurobindo speaks is about saying, don't make this distinction. And Sri Aurobindo says, the message that I give to West is the same message I give to India. It's not as if it's a message specially to the West. The message that Sri Aurobindo gives, and this Life Divine is a message. It is a message both to India and to the West. It is a universal measure, synthesis of the East and the West.
But can I ask you a question? And India was materialistic. Was she, at that time, also not spiritual?
India has been as materialistic as the West. West has been as spiritual as India. But in the West, the shadow of the spirit has been cast aside in its movement of materialism. And therefore, its spirituality has not been as profuse as in India. In India, materialism did play a great role. The wealth of India was the one attraction for the foreigners to come to India. So it is not as if India had no materialism. But the shadow of the East, of the spirit, was very heavily laid on it. That is the only difference. So, it is in that light of the East and West, in the light of a synthesis, that once again we read the synthesis in the approach in regard to the ultimate reality. Once again, ultimate reality in the West has come to be conceived with the mind much more vividly. And insofar as that is done in the East also, it is the same thing. It's not true that India is metaphysically weak, philosophically very weak. It's not true. In fact, Sri Aurobindo said, West has been as philosophical as India. It's not the other way around. The West has been as philosophical as India. But in India, reference to spiritual experience has been much more prominent, much more emphasized. You cannot see in the West there has been no reference to spiritual. The whole Middle Ages is nothing but reference to spiritual experience. But the emphasis that is laid in India on the spiritual experience has reached a very great height. And that is why Sri Aurobindo refers to that period when the spiritual experience was at its height, Veda and Upanishad. He does not refer to the later stages of spiritual experience, but to the highest. That's what Sri Aurobindo says. So strongly was this truth perceived in the ancient times, that the Vedantic seers, the word Vedantic seer is an ambiguous term, because in India, the word Vedanta is used in two periods. The Upanishad period is called Vedantic period, but also when Vedanta came to be commented upon, by a number of philosophers later on, that also is called a Vedantic period. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo says, in ancient times, the Vedantic years of the ancient times, not of the Middle Ages. In Middle Ages also there was a Vedantic period. It was a period of comment. That one was a period of pure spiritual outburst. So strong was this truth perceived in the ancient times that the Vedantic seers, even after they had arrived at the crowning idea, the convincing experience of Satchidananda as the highest possible expression of the reality to our consciousness, erected in their speculations or went on in their perceptions to an asat, a non-being beyond, which is not the ultimate existence, the pure consciousness, the infinite bliss of which all of our experiences are the expression or the deformation. So, this attempt of the Vedanta to speak of the reality not only as sat, but also as asat, indicates the highest effort of Vedantic seers not to be limited either by positive descriptions or by negative descriptions. It is to say ultimate reality has infinite attributes and even beyond that, you can only grasp at a few. Even the word sat, if you say it is an attribute understood by our mind of the reality or the highest experience of the spirit, even that need not be regarded as the highest. In fact, Taittiriya Upanishad says very clearly, in the beginning was the non-being, and then came the being. This is the statement of the Taittiriya Upanishad. In the beginning was the non-being, and then came the being. It is also referred to in the Rig Veda, in the Nasadiya Sukta. It starts with Na Asat. Nasadiya means, it's a sukta which begins the word Nasat. It says, in the beginning there was no non-being, nor was a being. It says, in the beginning there was neither non-being nor being. It is that state which is described in the Veda. So Taittiriya Upanishad says, in the beginning was the non-being, then came the being. Then Chandogya Upanishad says, how can that be? How can being come out of non-being? So he says, no, it was all being. Being is being is being. Everywhere is a being. So, now if you read all this together, the conclusion is that the Vedantic seers wanted to make it very clear. Do not quarrel whether that reality is non-being or being. Don't say it is sat, therefore not chit. Don't say it is chit, therefore not ananda. It is Satchidananda, and if you say it is not Satchidananda, that also is true. It is neti, neti, you cannot say this one, it is not that one. This is the highest possible definition, both intellectually and spiritually, to which we have arrived at. And this is what Sri Aurobindo wants to assert first of all, that if you try to find out the significance of all that is here around us, you are bound to look for the ultimate reality. And when you go to the search of ultimate reality, either by the mind or by the spiritual experience, you will be thrown to this concept, that ultimate reality is that which is indefinable. And whatever word you use, it is incomplete about it. It is omnipresent reality, in the light of which all that is here can be understood and can be signified. Now the only problem is that if that is the nature of reality, Having come to it, now comes the original question with which the whole thing started. What is all this world about? If this is the ultimate reality, then can this world and its design be understood? This is where we stand now in the organization of the idea of the life divine. We started with this question. We were led to inquire into the highest. We inquired into the highest. We came to this conclusion. Then we again now come to the question. Having seen this to be ultimate reality, what do you have to say about all that is here in this world? What is the design? Now, in regard to this now, Sri Aurobindo brings out a very important fact in the same paragraph that you are reading. In the transactions of a positive consciousness, I don't know if you got that sentence. In the transactions of a positive consciousness, even unity has to make the account with multiplicity. Now, this statement is a central statement in this chapter. In the light of the knowledge of ultimate reality that you have gained, there is one important fact in regard to which we are obliged to inquire. We have to relate that reality with the fact of what we say unity and multiplicity. This is also a fact. You see in this world everywhere multiplicity. You see everywhere things together. If not unity exactly, but things together. The surprising fact is in this world, you never see anything alone. This is a basic fact. Why is it that when I open my eyes, I don't see anything alone? This world is sad. There's a design in it. Why is it that I don't see things all by themselves, alone? Everywhere I see multiplicity. Everywhere I see togetherness. Therefore, this chapter is given to the consideration of the idea of unity and multiplicity. How do we understand this? What is multiplicity? What is unity? So let us read it. Huh? This is the question. We have to settle the account with regard to this question. Now you see the exposition of this question. For the many also are Brahman. For the many also are Brahman. Just mark the sentence. It's an argument. For, which because it begins for. Even unity has to make its account with multiplicity. For the many also are Brahman. Now this is a packed argument in the sense, if ultimate reality admits of everything, and if Upanishads speak of unity, you have to ask a question, what about multiplicity? That also is a fact. How is this reality which you are conceiving, how does it give an account of it? We can give an account of it. And Sri Aurobindo says that if you read the Vedanta, it also says many also are Brahman. Ultimate reality is not only unity, it is also many. This is a statement of the Vedanta. You may not see immediately how it can be, but Sri Aurobindo says we have got to take into account because Vedanta says not only unity is multiplicity, unity is Brahman, even the multiplicity, many also are Brahman. Now comes a more difficult and more complex statement. It is by vidya, the knowledge of the oneness, that we know God. Now to understand this statement, there is a vast background of Vedantic knowledge to be possessed. So sometimes you might say that one who is not acquainted with the Vedanta and all that Vedanta has spoken of this problem will simply see a statement being made. It is by vidya, the knowledge of oneness, as the know that we know God. What's the implication of this statement? In fact, in this sentence, the whole problem of unity and multiplicity is summarized. In the Vedanta, there is a definition of knowledge. This idea of knowledge is contrasted with the idea of ignorance. In the language of the Upanishad, knowledge is described as vidya, and ignorance is described as avidya. In the Upanishad, knowledge is equated with oneness. Avidya is equated with the perception of multiplicity. There is also in the Vedanta, varavidya and aparavidya, the two kinds of vidyas. There is also the statement that the highest condition of consciousness is obtained when you see oneness everywhere. Ekatvam anupashyataha. You see oneness everywhere. As long as you see multiplicity, you are in ignorance. You are in a state of knowledge when you see oneness. This statement is also made. It is also said in the Upanishad that those who follow knowledge, they go into greater darkness than those who follow avidya's darkness. It is also said that when you follow avidya, you can follow avidya, you will cross the depth. It is when you gain the knowledge that you will enjoy immortality. Now these are all the statements that you find in the Upanishads. So unless we are quite packed, it is so difficult to appreciate the argument which is stated here. It says in a very brief word, as it were, you already know about this problem. And this problem has been debated so much in the Vedanta. And when you come to this book, if you have not read it, you are not qualified to read it. As my mother said, you require 10 years to prepare yourself to read the Life Divine. And that is quite true. But if you do, without that preparation, we do need to have a lot of stopping on the way, which I am doing. Almost at every paragraph I am stopping so much because it is so packed. Unless you have a very good background of the history of religion, history of occultism, history of philosophy, history of yoga, history of sociology, history of politics, and unless you are thoroughly engaged in Western thought, metaphysics, and Western metaphysics, unless you have got a good grounding in Western psychology and Indian psychology, Eastern psychology, unless you are very well done with epistemology of the East and the West, unless you have this background, this book cannot be understood. But it can be understood if at the right time the right background is given. It's not impossible. That's why we are doing this kind of a task, to stop at every important point and even to take one paragraph from here, one paragraph from there, we are flying, so as to connect and to get the background necessary at the right time. And that's why Mother said also, do not dwell upon the text of Sri Aurobindo. The text should be left to the students themselves, but give them a great deal of background. And unless that background is given, we can't appreciate what Sri Aurobindo has said. So here, this question of oneness, multiplicity, knowledge and ignorance, these words are extremely important, and unless we know how these words have been used in the Veda and the Upanishads, and in the history of Indian philosophy particularly, we won't be able to understand this chapter. So, I will go through these lines and then again stop at a good point and to refer to some background. It is by vidya, the knowledge of the oneness, that we know God. Without it, avidya, the relative and multiple consciousness, is a night of darkness and a disorder of ignorance. Yet, this is Ishopanishad, if we exclude the field of that ignorance, if we get rid of avidya as if it were a thing non-existent and unreal, then knowledge itself becomes a sort of obscurity and a source of imperfection. We become as men blinded by a light, so that we can no longer see the field with that light illumines. I shall stop here because it's a very important statement. The Ishopanishad describes the highest state where all that gives suffering and all that is painful is destroyed. What is that state? Yasmin sarvani bhutani atma eva abhut vijanataha tatra ko mohaha kaha shokaha ekatvam anupashyataha. That in which the self has become all the becomings, multiplicity, and having vijanataha, there is a distinction between janataha and vijanataha. That is a Sanskrit etymological understanding. Upanishad could have used the word janataha. Isn't it? Janata means knowing. Vijanataha means knowing much more. Vishishta rupena jnanam praptam iti vijnanam. So, vijanataha, that is to say, not only vishishta, but vistarena, that also vijanata. Not only specially known, but also vistarena, that which is known in all its complexity, vistara, in all its expansion. The Atma is one, but it is that Atma has become sarvani bhutani, all this multiplicity. One who has known Atma And one who has known in expansion that this Atman has become all, is not only knowledge of oneness, but also knowledge of all. When the two are together, the word used is vijanataha. It is only when you have known one and many, then tatra ko mohaha, then where does lie any moha? Kaha shokaha, what suffering can remain? But it is finally ekatvam anupashyata. The Atman is one, all Bhutani are many. They are also yet seen ekatvam. Even that is seen as one. The one and many are both combined together. One who knows one who knows one has become many, and yet one has seen oneness. That is vijanataha. This is a statement which has to be underlined. The Vedantic seers maintain that you have to know multiplicity, you have to know the oneness, you have to see unity and multiplicity also as one. Your perception of unity has been so sharpened that even when you see multiplicity or oneness, these two collide with each other, even that is not allowed. The two are so unified that ultimately you see the one. All this is one. That is to say, it is not as if one is one reality, multiplicity is another reality. You are not seeing both. Even if you see both, one and multiplicity, you still have to reach a point where you see all one. That is a state to which Upanishad has drawn our attention. Then it says, vidyamcha avidyamcha yasmat, vidyamcha avidyamcha yastat vedo bhayam sa, avidyaya mrityum tirtva vidyaya amritam ashnute. One who knows ubhayam, Veda, ubhayam. Ubhayam means both. One who knows both, vidya and avidya, one who knows vidya and avidya, one who knows both, only that person crosses death by avidya and enjoys immortality by vidya. Now these are very pregnant words and very difficult, paradoxical words, but they are there. And they are deliberately put in the way in which they are put. Now all that is stated when Sri Aurobindo speaks of this sentence. And if you are not aware of this background, we would only feel that something incomprehensible has been said, stated and then passed over. But that is not the case, because it's a very important qualification. I read again. It is by vidya, the knowledge of the oneness, that we know God. Without it, avidya, the relative and multiple consciousness, it is a night of darkness and a disorder of ignorance. Yet if we exclude the field of that ignorance, if we get rid of avidya as if it were a thing non-existent and unreal, then knowledge itself becomes a sort of obscurity and a source of imperfection. We become as men blinded by a light, so that we can no longer see the field with that light illumines. Now I would like to raise two questions. Why Sri Aurobindo refers to Vedanta when this question of unity and multiplicity has been raised? It is because the way in which the problem of unity and multiplicity has been seen in the West is almost negligently seen. Now I should be pardoned when I say this, because those who have studied only Western philosophy and not Indian philosophy, they would think that it is a depreciation of the Western philosophy. But if you study both impartially, you can say this problem of multiplicity and unity has been seen in Indian philosophy much more profoundly and much more deeply. It's a historical fact. It is not that one wants to be partial to India as against the West. It's a fact. If you study this problem of unity and multiplicity in the West, this problem has not been sufficiently seen. Now let me explain, because it's a very serious proposition I'm making. The first time metaphysically the question very seriously is raised is in Plato, the question of unity and multiplicity. And I shall like to dwell upon this question, because this whole question can be sufficiently realized in its depth only when we visit Eastern and Western thought on this question. And all that is in this chapter, that is why unless we visit all this, we won't understand the statements which are made in this chapter. In Plato, the greatest book that he has written is The Republic. But there are many other books of dialogues also which are quite important and quite illuminating. Plato has emphasized in his philosophy the concept of the universe. He discovers that by process of thinking, you are obliged to come to the concept of the universe. If you stand in the world, you see multiplicity everywhere. And you try to understand what is all this multiplicity. Then he says, in this multiplicity, there are many things which are similar to each other. Now this fact of similarity is picked up by Plato, that all things look pell-mell, but there are many things in this world which are similar to each other. There are two roses. It is multiple roses, many roses, but they are all similar to each other. Each one is different from the other, but all the roses are similar to each other. It's a very striking fact. A good philosopher is one who not only sees facts as anybody can see, but who can see patterns in facts, designs in facts, if at all. That's a philosophical attitude, to see design, to see meaning. Is there any meaning in so many multiplicities that we see? And the first thing that he brings out is that there are many things which are similar to each other. Then he asks the question, can we think of the explanation of similarities? Why do two flowers resemble each other? Is there any clue in this world? So he comes to the conclusion that the similarities between two flowers cannot be explained if there is not one universal flower. There must be a universal which only can explain similar things. There are all kinds of courts. People sleep on small cots, big cots, more refined cot, another kind of cot, many beds. Why do you all call them the beds? Although they are all similar, but each one is different. But why do you call them by one word, bed? Because there is some universal element in all of them which is the same. This is the rational argument of Plato, that you cannot explain the similarities between things in the world unless there is a universal. And such a universal must exist because similarities do exist. Therefore, he says, the universal bed must be existing. There must be a universal lotus somewhere. He uses also the word archetypal. The archetype must exist somewhere. It is this archetype, this universal, in the light of which multiplicity can be explained. So unity and multiplicity, he says, can be reconciled only with the idea that there is a universal which somehow manifests. And there was a big problem for him. Is universal only one? Yes, only one universal flower, one universal lotus, one universal bed. How does it become multiple? If it is only one, how does it become multiple? Now, here is a question which, if you study Plato impartially, you'll find that he is hesitant to give a reply. In one of his dialogues, he says, if there is one, there can't be many. If there is one, there can't be many. You cannot explain multiplicity. It is one. One is one. How does it become multiple? This is one blockade in his thought. If you read, this is a question which is left. At another time, he was asked, dirt exists in the world, and dirty things do resemble each other. Was there a universal dirt somewhere? And he refrains, he says, how can it be? A universal dirt, unthinkable. Universal beauty, yes, there must be universal beauty. But universal dirt, he refrains from answering the question. But the question is there. He refrains from answering that question. There is a third answer he gives. It is that there is, apart from the universal, there must be something other than the universal. There must be something which you can call matter, which you can call matter if you like. Universal, according to Plato, explains all similarities. That universal must exist. Therefore, universal is real. It must exist. Otherwise, similarities can't be explained. That universal must exist, is real. If that is real, then the matter is not universal. Matter is something here which he calls, you may call it existing, non-existing. That is real. This matter, you may call it existing, may not call it exist. It is something which is not existing, but something on which the universal can be imprinted. And that existing, non-existing thing which is going on, as it were, under a printing press, the universal is stamping on this existing, non-existing thing which is fluctuating. So all the world is a flux. And the universal is all the time imprinting itself. Therefore, they are all similar. Similarity is nothing but copies of the universal. All that are similar, he says that all similar things in the world are imprints of the universal, and they are all copies of the universal. Therefore, none of this actually captures the real universal. There are so many beautiful objects in the world, but that beauty is never captured. It is universal beauty. It's the most wonderful. All other beautiful things in the world, they only partake of that beauty. You can give some idea of what that beauty would be like, but that beauty surpasses, which can only be conceived according to him. You can conceive in thought, but you can never experience it. But it must be real. That real which can be conceived at your highest is the universal. And what you see are only copies, faint copies of that universal. Now I am giving a simple exposition of the grand philosophy of Plato in regard to this important matter. According to me, this is sufficient to understand how difficult it is that even a philosopher like Plato, at his best, gave only this answer to this question. And even we who are hardly any philosophers comparable to him, we can see the unsatisfactoriness of the answer that he gives. Now this question of the universal and similarities, the question of particulars, the question of matter in which all multiplicity is basically seen, this question has remained exactly as it was in Plato. I am giving a very sweeping statement.
Why does Plato say may or may not for the material?
That's the important point. All these things you see are only particulars. These material things that you see are all particulars. Particulars are all in flux. They come into existence, they go away after some time. Therefore, they exist, they don't exist. Particularity, existing, non-existing, flux, all that is there before our eyes. And this cannot be explained unless there is universal idea. That must be permanent. It's not in a flux. It is always present. A flower was in the past, it is also present, it will be in the future. That basic stuff is going on all the time. Now the problem that he was facing in his dialogue on this question has remained Not that this has not been raised again and again. The whole history of Western philosophy is, in a sense, a revisiting of this problem. Since I am required to only give you a summary idea, in its most essential point, I would simply say that this question that he raised has not been answered. Can one become many? This is one question. Secondly, how does the universal manifest in things which are similar? What is the process by which this can happen? There must be something different from universal on which all these things are presented. How does it happen? And why do you need to suppose some basic stuff which exists, which does not exist, on which the universal are printed? In one form or the other, this question has been raised. It is easy to posit oneness. Having posited oneness to discuss the plurality is difficult. And to explain the plurality in the world as it is difficult. It is easy to say that one universal is real, all the rest is existing, non-existing. Is unreal. You may not be satisfied, but it is so. There is no other possible answer. In the West, there is a big tendency to state that all particulars are appearances. They are not real. They are all parts of the whole universal. How these are parts of the whole? They must be, because the whole must exist and the parts, all you are seeing here, so it must be. But how? The highest expression of this problem is in Bradley. Bradley is supposed to be the most refined Platonist. If you bring Plato to the highest manifestation, all the ideas put forward by Plato, not that he agrees with Plato in everything, but if you bring this concept of reality, that reality must be universal, and that all the rest, particulars, etc., must be part of it, and all the parts must be only appearances and not reality. Neither illusions nor real, therefore he calls them appearances. This is the highest conclusion to which you arrive on this line of thinking. Now those who do not accept this reasoning at all, these are all called idealists who fall in line with Plato. All idealists accept universal as real. And they regard particulars as appearances. Now, as against it, there is also another view. We started with Aristotle, the student of Plato. Aristotle himself was not satisfied with Plato. So he said, I will explain things better. Bertrand Russell, while discussing Aristotle, he said that Aristotle tried to do more than what Plato had proposed to do. But ultimately he came back to Plato without admitting that what he says is Plato. And secondly, he says that because of this unclarity, Aristotle is very difficult to understand. He says, I have now solved the problem. If he doesn't solve the problem, you think that he must have solved. So you don't understand where is the solution. And from that time onwards, there has been in West a tendency to deprecate idealism. Idealism has continued right up to the present day, even today, it is still there. Idealism should be actually regarded as ideaism, not idealism. It regards idea as ultimately real. Universal ideas is real, that is the basic theory of idealism. Now those who have opposed us say that this whole problem arises because you assume that similarities can be explained only by universal idea which must be existing. You said this reasoning is faulty.
I think your Plato said that ridiculous arguments it almost makes you think of the Mayavada Shankaracharya.
I agree, yes. Therefore I am saying, without telling, it should come out in our own minds. That you can see.
But then when we talk about the West being matter-oriented.
This is not true. That's what I say. It's not true. All these are so pathetic ways of looking at East and West. It's not a very impartial way of looking at East and West. That's why what Sri Aurobindo says, that this great distinction which is made between East and Western is too exaggerated. It's not true. We need to look at the whole world as if it is a world thought and not quarrel about East and West and all that. These are all puerile quarrels, you might say. Now, those who believe that this argument of Plato, right from this time, and that is very why it is very interesting to read Plato's discussion in Bertrand Russell's book. He is the latest writer who has written on Plato from that other point of view. So he says that there is no need to assume that there is a universal. He said, I don't deny that there are many cats which are similar to each other. I can even say there is something like cattiness. Fine. Why should I assume that there is some cattiness somewhere in heaven which is being imprinted in all the cats? There is cattiness, it's all right, there is cattiness, and that's the end of the matter. If you like, you coin a word which is applicable to all of them who look alike. So that in your conversation there is no problem. You can converse very easily. You have labeled, there is a class of X, Y, Z. They all look like each other. There is cattiness in them. And you give one word, cat. Problem is resolved. Where is the problem? There is only multiplicity in the world. Fact is only manyness. Where is unity? What is this unity idea? It is true they are similar. So many things happen similarly. So what? Why should there be a problem? You raised a problem. Why should they be similar? They are similar. That's the end of the matter. Don't raise those questions. There are no such things. Heavenly born intuitions which come from above and tell you about universals. You require, of course, for language, you require universals. For talking, instead of saying this cat, that cat, that cat, it's convenient for me to say cats. For the sake of conversation, for the sake of language, dialogue, You abbreviate. This is called nominalist theory. The universal is only a name, not a reality existing in heaven. All universals, so-called universals, are only words. They don't really mean that there must be a universal cat, only then all these cats can be explained. There are cats, that is, a plurality is a fact, multiplicity is a fact. And that's the end of the matter. What is the problem? So you can see here another line of philosophical thinking which cuts the problem right at the very root. Plato found it difficult to explain why things are similar to each other. Why should they be similar to each other? So he said, Plato, unnecessary is a question which you should not have. Things are similar to each other. And of course you require, for language, you do require some code words. So make a code word. Don't say this corresponds to some universal. It's a code word which can be applied to many cats which look similar to each other. That's all. Now you can see that many philosophers are not satisfied with this answer. One of the latest philosophers is Blanchard, who wrote 2 volumes on nature of thought, who points out, whether you like it or not, there is in thought process a very important process which is called implication. This implies this. This word implication is very important. No thought is possible unless you come to recognize implication. Then he said that implication carries with it an idea of necessity. A implies B only if it is necessarily implying. If light has gone off, it's a B, it's because the power supply has gone. Something has happened in the powerhouse. The absence of light here implies necessarily that power supply has gone out. It's necessarily. To a child you have to say that, look, this has happened here, that has happened there. But in thought process you don't need to every time. The moment you see the light has gone off here, it implies that in powerhouse something has happened about the light, about electricity. It implies. Now this important point of implication is connected with necessity. Now necessity implies that whether you like it or not, something happens in the world necessarily. Things happen necessarily. Therefore, with regard to the things in the world, you ask the question, why at all this should happen necessarily? So Plato was quite right in saying, 2 flowers resemble each other. You must ask the question, what is the necessity of it? Russell saying it has happened. He said, laziness of thought. You must ask a further question. Why should this happen? This is a natural condition of your mind. Mind is seeking an answer. You can say to somebody, now don't bother me. Don't ask me this question. So he said, those people who do not relate particulars with universals are those who are not faithful to the process of thought and the capacity of thought to discover connections in the light of which you are better enlightened about the whole world. The world becomes much more explicable, much more understandable, if you can find out connections, necessary connections, and then the thought is truly satisfied. There are people who may not raise all these questions, it is all waste of time. But their mind is not satisfied. The mind is really satisfied. It may become lazy, it may become weary, but not satisfied. The mind really becomes satisfied only if you find the necessary connection. And when you connect things of the world necessarily with something which can explain, there are particulars who seem to be similar. You have got to answer, so Plato was quite right in raising this question, that if things look similar, there must be a reason behind it. What is the necessity of it? And he succeeded quite a great deal in conceiving that the whole world ultimately can be conceived in three terms, truth, beauty and goodness. And even today, nobody can deny that ultimately all human beings, whether they like it or not, they are obliged to speak in terms of truth, beauty and goodness. The whole history of thought is before you. And that is the greatness of Plato, that long ago he pointed out that all your thought processes ultimately can be reduced to these three concepts, truth, beauty and goodness, and they are universal. So how can you say Plato was puerile or muddle-headed, as many people think today, better philosophers? How can you say that? Now, these two thoughts which are opposed to each other are even today not reconciled in the West. Now, that thought which is anti-Platonic tends to emphasize the particular, saying particular requires no explanation. Particular is particular. Therefore, this thought tends to emphasize the individual. There are individuals, that is the whole statement. In this world, there are individuals. The effort of idealistic thought to put individuals into a bundle of whole, according to these thinkers, is wrong. It's a Platonic way of bundling together under one universal. And according to them, this is what has resulted in Hegelianism. Hegel, just as Bradley, I spoke of Bradley, but parent of Bradley philosophically is Hegel. I speak of Bradley because if you study even Hegel, there are defects in his philosophical thought, which, according to my understanding, have been repaired by Bradley. But to many people, Hegel stands supreme in taking Platonism to its highest conclusion. So according to Hegel, all particular things in the world can be subsumed under higher universals and higher universals until you come to one vast universal whole in which all are included, everything stands explained. No part in the world exists just like that. No part in the world exists contingently. Every part in the world exists necessarily. Every part exists necessarily on account of the whole. Because the whole, therefore the part as it is. All individuals, you, me, everybody, is actually nothing but a part of the whole. And there are greater and greater wholes. There is a hierarchy of holds in this world according to Hegel. Now comes Hegelian political philosophy as a result of this. And he points out that the highest whole is a state. What is a state? State is nothing but an organized society. Every human being is a part of a society. You can't escape it. What you are is because of the whole society as it is. You are a part of it. You wear a certain dress because you are part of the society. You all look alike because you are all Indians. In other words, all particularities can be reduced ultimately to the whole. And he says the highest whole is a state. State is nothing but the society taken as a whole, which has the highest intelligence. It's a combination of all intelligence of the whole society. And it strives to do the best for everyone. This is the concept of the state. State is the combination of the highest will, highest intelligence of all the people in a society put together, and which looks after the highest good of all. Now follow the conclusion from it. An individual must recognize that he is a part of the whole state. Because that is the reality of him. A flower must be a flower because there is a universal flower. You are what you are because of the society. Recognize that you are a part of the whole. This whole has created a state. The highest thought of the society is put into the state. Therefore, the highest good of the individual lies in the highest good of the state. And the highest that you can do is to obey the state. And do what the state asks you to do, because it perceives the whole. This is called the idealist theory of the state. The highest destiny of the individual, this is our subject, the highest destiny of the individual according to this theory, is to recognize that you are a part of the state, and that you must abide harmoniously with what the state dictates. It is the destiny of the individual. You are a part, you will remain a part, you will die as a part. And as long as you remain a part, you have to be subservient to the state. Authority of the state is the supreme authority. Of course, there is something higher than the state, but that is still to be built. It has not yet formed. The world is still in formation. At present, only the state is the highest form that has been created. Therefore, as long as that is the highest state for an individual, the best is to subserve himself as a servant of the state. And that is your real freedom. Your bondage is as long as you do not, you collide with others. You feel a bondage because you do not understand it. You don't understand that your highest happiness and satisfaction, fulfillment will come if you admit the whole state. Therefore, the state has a responsibility of obliging you to obey the state. Therefore, the state has a duty to ask all the citizens to abide thoroughly to the decisions of the state. Now, this is the idealist theory of the state. It is on that basis, if you take it forward, you can understand Hitler. Hitler is state. He decides, you should do this, everybody should do it. He has a right to make you free. Your freedom consists in obeying. If you don't obey, you are not free. Therefore, state must impose upon you so that you can become free. To be free is to be able to subserve willingly, knowingly, intelligently, and accept the order of the state. Now, it is because of this reason that idealist theory of the state and idealism as such has come into great disrepute. It wants to belittle the individual. And Sri Aurobindo in this chapter speaks of belittling the individual. And that can be understood properly if you understand this whole trend of thought, which is very powerful in the state. And therefore the opposite political theory has started saying every individual is free. His fulfillment is uppermost. Society is only a makeshift. State is a makeshift. It's like Bertrand Russell wrote a book, Authority and the Individual. And to show that this whole authoritarian idea of the state is false. Authority can be only a part, a necessary evil, you might say. People do not normally gel with each other, therefore there's a need of some kind of a law, some kind of public order. Having granted that public order, every individual should be completely free. Autonomy, self-will of the individual, his full fulfillment as he thinks is best. This is what is called liberalism. Every individual should be free to determine his own, whatever he wants, his highest good. Who is the state to try to tell me what is good for me? Therefore, in the West, there is a tremendous dichotomy between the idea of individual freedom and the role of the state. Now, this is not merely an idea. As you see, in the case of Hitler, this idea was put into practice. On this ground, that the highest good of the individual, the destiny of the individual is to be subservient to the state. Now Hegel is a great precursor of Marx. The only difference between Marx and Hegel is that according to Hegel, ultimate reality is idea, is spirit, he called also spirit. According to Marx, the ultimate reality is matter. And this matter is manifesting little by little into groups. Smaller groups, higher groups, higher groups. Through a dialectical movement in which there is opposition between the lower movement and the higher movement. Ultimately, a synthesis is reached, in which the dichotomies will be all washed out. Ultimately, there should be complete harmony of all. But we are not at that point. Why? Because there is today a great antinomy between individual and society, and between two classes in society, the laborer and the capitalist. And there is antagonism between the two. This antagonism is because the capitalists have gained power to such a degree that laborers can never defeat them. It's impossible. Why? Because capital is a big power. It has got gunpowder with it. So that ultimately if anybody revolts against the capitalism, the gunpowder of capitalism will throw it out, destroy the opposition. Then what is the solution? The solution is, call all the laborers together, unite all the laborers. And before the capitalists can use the gunpowder, you take the gunpowder in your hands and eliminate them. And you establish your sovereignty. And then you are a state. Once you are a state, all people should obey you. This individuality, individualism, freedom, what is all this? You don't know what is the best for you. The state knows what is best for you. State decides. State is planning everything. Whatever state plans, you follow that plan. That's your goodness. That is your highest welfare. The destiny of the individual is to be a part of the society, of the state, to follow the state. Once that happens, the laborers now are wiser and they will eliminate all the capitalists. If they don't obey, they'll be finished. Therefore, they don't believe in non-violence. You just finish them. And that is what happened in the Russian Revolution. And those who remain alive, they have to obey. They accepted to obey. So this idea of idealism has gone right up to communist idea. It is that idea which is in China, which is now coming up in Nepal, and which is coming up strongly in India. This is the force of this idea. It's not only the question of destiny of individual, it is extremely important. It is right at our door actually today. We have to think out very clearly what is the truth. What is really the individual? What is multiplicity? What is society? What is state? What is ultimate reality? It is against this background, I was saying that the way in which this question was discussed in India has never been discussed in the West. Now let us see how in India this question has been discussed. In Indian thought, there was a discovery of unity, of oneness. It was not only like in Plato conceived, universal was not only conceived, but was sought to be experienced. And they arrived at a concept and experience of ekatvam to such an extent that the idea of moha and shoka could be eliminated from your very fiber of your being. And in that concept of oneness, the one was seen to have given birth to many. Atma eva abhut sarvani bhutani. Atma itself became all these. And this was affirmed on the basis of what they called vijanataha. If you have the full knowledge, then you have the knowledge of one, that there is one. And that one has become many. This is the starting point of the argument of the whole Indian thought. As you can see the distinction between the dealing with the question. Philosophically, it is true that Plato argued two similars require to be explained. Now, this was a rationalistic approach. You start with some data and then you ask rationally, why is it so? Why must it be so? That's a rationalistic approach. A search for explanation in terms of necessity, in search of meaning, that is rationalism. In India, this question also was raised, but later on. The question was raised in terms of experience. Can you reach the highest possible experience? And there they use these words. Knowledge means knowledge of oneness. Ignorance means knowledge of multiplicity. This whole concept of knowledge and ignorance as conceived in India is absent in the whole history of Western philosophy. The word ignorance does not mean what in India the word ignorance means. Ignorance in the West means partial knowledge. Partial knowledge which gives partial perceptions. Such perceptions can be remedied by a further expansion of the field of your knowledge and eliminate as much error as possible, arrive as much truth as possible. The arrival of complete elimination of ignorance is impossible. Arrival at a complete knowledge is impossible. Complete arrival of truth is impossible. You can approximate more and more. Whereas here, there is a clear statement, there is a knowledge. You possess knowledge of oneness. In the West, the idea of oneness was only a conception. In Plato, it is only the idea of universal was a concept. You cannot perceive it, you cannot experience it. Even the whole of which Bradley speaks, of which Hegel speaks, even the communist speaks of the whole, is only an idea. Nobody can experience the whole. And nobody can have the knowledge which one can have if you could rise to the highest top and see all as one. In India, this is the concept that you can. You can rise to a perception where you have a complete experience of oneness. And you can see that this oneness gives rise to multiplicity. Not like in Plato, that on non-existent existent matter, things are printed and therefore there are only copies. Particulars are only copies. Multiplicity is nothing consisting of plurality. Plurality is nothing but copies of the universal. Against that concept we have got here that Atma eva abhut sarvani bhutan. Atma eva abhut. It became that one manifested the many. Multiplicity comes out of oneness. This is regarded as the vijanata. The complete knowledge consists of knowing the one and knowing one which gives rise to many. Ekam eva advitiyam. This is the reality. Bahusyam bahusyam. There may be many and many became. As a result of which you can say that reality is Brahman, which is one, you can also say Sarvam Khalu Idam Brahma. All this is also Brahman. So all plurality, multiplicity, all that you can call, everything included, all manifestations, Sarvani Bhutani, are all manifestations of the One. Now, we must make a distinction between all constitute the whole One, all constituting the whole One, and One manifesting all. In the case of the first proposition, without all, you cannot arrive at One. In the other one, One is a starting point. Out of Him the many come out. And these distinctions are very important in the final understanding of ultimate reality. It is not as if all put together is that One. As Sri Aurobindo says, that reality is not a sum or concourse. I think the very first sentence of this chapter, we had that word. The fifth line of the first paragraph. Chapter 5, the very first paragraph. Sixth line, no? The reality is One and not a sum or concourse. It's a very important statement. What is the nature of the One? It's not a sum or concourse. It is One out of which multiplicity can manifest. We must be very particular, precise about this concept. The One of which is spoken in Upanishad is not a sum or concourse. That reality is One which is capable of manifesting multiplicity. If you want to understand the destiny of the individual, we must start with this proposition that individuals who are so many, multiple, they are not the starting point. In the pluralistic idea of the West, you start with individuals and give them complete freedom and see that they don't fight and therefore make a public order law. But otherwise, everyone is free to do what he likes. In the idealistic state, all are there. You start with them, but they're all bundled together, put them together and make One, and then allow that One to manifest, to impose its will upon all the others. But basically, even that One is only concourse, is a sum of all. Neither of these two concepts is identical with this concept. You start with the One. It is the One from which multiplicity arises. And Sri Aurobindo says that when you use this word one and many, these are words not to be confused mathematically. One is not something that is more than zero and less than two. There is a oneness. And when you speak of multiplicity, it's not plurality, it is multiplicity. All that is manifested is multiple, not plural. How to conceive this mentally, intellectually? Sri Aurobindo says that you require a new language actually if you want to express correctly. And the best way is the word Brahman, the essence and manifestation, the essence which expands. So now we are introducing this paragraph, the concept of one, many, identification of the one, knowledge of one as knowledge, knowledge of multiplicity as ignorance. And we have still not gone very far in the argument. Only, this was only to explain the burden of these words which are used so that we become quite clear as to what is being meant. Now, why is it that the word multiplicity came to be identified with the word ignorance? Why? And what is ignorance? These questions have not been properly answered, although they are so capital, so important. They remain unanswered for thousands of years in India. They are used. They are defined. They are debates. The very first time that ignorance was described was in the Veda, with the word achitti. And knowledge was called chitti. Achitti and chitti, according to Vedic knowledge, have both to be understood and known. And when you know both, then only you are true knowledge. Then achitti and chitti both are known. It is like Upanishad, Ishopanishad, which says that ubhayam vidyam cha avidyam cha, both vidya and avidya, Veda ubhayam. You have to know both. It is that which Aurobindo refers to here. It's only when you know ignorance and knowledge together that you have the true knowledge. And that is the mystery, that is the whole question which is debated in this chapter. Let us now read again that sentence. It is by vidya, the knowledge of oneness, that we know God. This is the third paragraph, at the end of the third paragraph. It is by vidya, the knowledge of the oneness, that we know God. Without it, avidya, the relative and multiple consciousness, the definition of avidya, the relative and multiple consciousness is the definition of the word avidya, is a night of darkness and a disorder of ignorance. You can see the precision of Sri Aurobindo's language. Ignorance is defined as the relative and multiple consciousness. And this relative and multiple consciousness has been described as a night of darkness and a disorder of ignorance. Yet, if you exclude the field of that ignorance, if you get rid of avidya, as if it were a thing non-existent and unreal, then knowledge itself becomes a sort of obscurity and a source of imperfection. We become as men blinded by a light so that we can no longer see the field with that light illumines. Such is the teaching, calm, wise and clear, of our most ancient sages. They had the patience and the strength to find and to know. They had also the clarity and humility to admit the limitation of our knowledge. They perceived the borders where it has to pass into something beyond itself. It was a later impatience of heart and mind, vehement attraction or to an ultimate bliss or high masterfulness of pure experience and transcendent intelligence which sought the one to deny the many, and because it had received the breath of the heights, scorned or recoiled from the secret of the depths. But the steady eye of the silent wisdom perceived that to know God really, it must know Him everywhere equally and without distinction, considering and valuing but not mastered by the oppositions through which He shines. In these three, four lines, Sri Aurobindo gives a description of the entire history of Indian philosophy. We start with the Upanishadic Maitreya. We start with the real definition of knowledge and ignorance. Then Sri Aurobindo said that that patience which harmonizes one and many, that patience was lost in due course of time. Because to harmonize the two is very difficult and very time consuming. But it is possible to rush to an experience of bliss. It is more difficult to reconcile that bliss with the problems of suffering in the world, and there also to find bliss over there. It takes a longer time. You should have greater patience, greater effort. Because that patience was lost, there came a cleavage. It was decided to say, the knowledge of the one is called vidya. Multiple consciousness is avidya. And avidya has to be thrown out. And then one step farther, which we were discussing last time. Avidya is multiplicity, is not only to be thrown away, but to declare it to be non-existent. Philosophically, you cannot throw away anything which is there in the philosophically. You have to take into account all. If many exist, if ignorance exists, philosophically you are obliged to explain it. But there was this impatience. Therefore, not only was ignorance and multiplicity thrown out, but even declare it doesn't exist so that you don't have to explain it. You have to explain it only if it really exists. Somehow that problem remains and you are confronted with the problem. But if you ultimately declare it doesn't exist at all, the problem is resolved. In the case of Plato, the problem was, he said that this exists, this doesn't exist. In Indian philosophy, through Shankara, it was said the world and ignorance exists. Vyavaharik Satta is there, but does not exist. Ultimately, it doesn't exist. And finally, you say, it never existed. You first of all say, it exists, yes, yes, I see it, Vivarika. Then I say it is tuccha, it is trifle. And then you say it is non-existent altogether. It never existed, it's only knowledge. So Sri Aurobindo says, it is because of that reason that we have at present a big problem. And we are not able to answer the question properly, the destiny of multiplicity individual. It is only when we are again gain that patience of the Upanishads and are prepared to go into all the vicissitudes of the problem that we will find a proper answer to the question, what is the individual and what is the destiny of the individual. Now, the rest of the chapter is a preparation to this long process. I think we shall have to have another time to go through that, but I was only trying to introduce this particular point that so long as we are impatient, we won't be able to answer this question. It is possible to declare multiplicity is ignorance. And even to say multiplicity does not exist and ignorance does not exist. This has been said. Evidently, intellectually it is not satisfying. This is one of the reasons why Westerners, when they come to study Indian philosophy, and when they grapple with this question of knowledge and ignorance, they find bewildered. And they ultimately say there is only muddle-headedness in India. And ultimately everything is Maya, everything is false, everything is thrown out, go to Himalayas. That is the only impression they get ultimately after reading all this. And they are not wrong. The way in which we are expounding, what we have done, corresponds to the truth behind this kind of perception which has arisen. Therefore, we have to give a true account, a full account, and give a true and proper answer. Now, to give that answer, of course, the whole book has to be read, but in this chapter itself, Sri Aurobindo takes us rapidly. That's why this chapter is difficult. It's a rapid movement of thought which takes you straight to the answer of the problem, and the rapid steps which are taken are a description of the world in which we live, the way in which the thought thinks of the world, the way in which our life force reacts to the world, the terms in which we are working in the world, and the levels at which we are working in the world. Mentally, when you come to think of the world, I'm only summarizing now, this is an introduction. Mentally, when you think, the world appears either as an illusion or the world seems to be the only real and spirit as illusion. This is how we see the world. These are the two ways by which we see. That's how Sri Aurobindo summarizes these two points of view rapidly. Secondly, the mind seeks harmony. And so does life also seek harmony. That is the second way in which we deal with the world as it is. Then as we move forward, we find that there are three terms in which the life moves, mind moves. It's a summary of the whole experience of the world. These three terms are individual, universal, transcendent. The whole world, if you examine, It is nothing but a transaction among these three terms: individual, universal, transcendental. And the whole history of thought is nothing but a history of a travel of the relation between these three terms. And thirdly, the whole world is nothing but a movement in which there is a constant rising from level to level. When you pass from material life, you try to reject all other styles of life, vital life, mental life, spiritual life. When you go to the vital life, you neglect the physical life. Some of the geniuses, they work day and night. They don't care about the body. There's a creative impulse, so powerful. Overnight you work up to 5 o'clock in the morning. A creative impulse. And the body is rejected. The need of sleep is rejected. When you go to mental life, then physical life is neglected, vital life is neglected. When you go to spiritual life, mental life is neglected, vital life is neglected, physical life is neglected. This is the whole world as we see it. Finally, we see the life moving at three levels. If you see the whole world, there is a subconscious level, the conscious level, and the superconscious level. Now, when you travel through all these levels of consciousness, when you debate, you travel, this chapter is difficult because you can see how many things are said in 2 pages. The whole thing is described. And there, Sri Aurobindo points out, it is that point. When you travel, you begin to understand where individual stands. And the truth of individual begins to appear truly in this process. What do we perceive? The whole important point is the whole world is moving from the subconscious to the conscient. And this conscient, we are all conscious beings. We conscious beings are not sitting silent. It's not as if now we are all having an armchair and doing nothing. We are striving to become more and more conscious, whether you like it or not. We are striving to become super conscient. It is inevitable. You are doing it. That is what Sri Aurobindo is a fact. If anybody wants to question, let him question, then see. Even his questioning arises because he wants to be more conscious than what he is. Even his question arises, you are doubting your proposition because he says that you are less conscious than I am. All our effort is to be more and more conscious. It is in this effort, in the effort in which you try to harmonize the standpoint which regards the world as an illusion or spirit as an illusion, in the movement in which you discover the transaction between the individual, transcendental, the universal, in an effort where physical life, vital life, mental life, spiritual life, all are attempted to be integrated, as a result of which from the conscious life you are trying to become super conscious, it is at this nodal point that the importance of the individual is realized. I am only concluding for the sake of answering the question, but it is answered quite powerfully. That although we are trying to move towards super conscious, we can never reach the superconscious unless the individual, this is the importance of the individual, unless the individual is able to discard the ignorance in himself, not in the whole world, in himself, and attains a state of what is called knowledge, unless he himself is able to see oneness in multiplicity, so where neither multiplicity is thrown out nor oneness, because that is the real knowledge. Unless he discovers in himself oneness and multiplicity, that great message of the Upanishads, ekatvam anupashyataha, kaha moha kaha shokaha, in which you say atma eva abhut sarvani bhutani, in which atma itself became all, vijanata, unless you get this knowledge, inwardly, individually, unless this happens, this train will not be able to go farther. Whole world may do whatever you may like. You may go to Moon or Jupiter. But the train, our human train today has reached a point, such a point, where you've got to recognize that individual, your greatest efforts were made by which each individual comes to realize that there is oneness which manifests multiplicity. This is the state of knowledge which he has to acquire individually himself. And each one of us has to get it. Then only what is designed in the world will be fulfilled. What is designed in the world is the divine life on the earth, the Raslila. But this Raslila will not be possible unless every individually is able to do this. That's why this whole question of destiny of the individual. What is individual? In which so much importance is given to it, that unless that happens individually, and that is what is demanded by the design of the world. If you look at the whole world demands divine life, but don't think divine life will come unless each individual arrives at this realization. It is not partial knowledge of each one combined together will create full knowledge. Each individual has to have vijanataha. And when that happens, then we shall be able to play a role that will be the Raslila on this earth, physically. This is the answer of this question. And then only the problem of pain, suffering will really go out, not only individually, but collectively. If you really want a total harmony of the world, if you really want to eliminate suffering in the world, injustice in the world, only then it will happen. But this is the conclusion of this chapter. All right? We can stop here today, huh?